For those who don't know you, don't know me, my name is Brendan. Some of you might not know me because I haven't been in church since October, the first week in October. I was joking this morning saying that probably one of the reasons why Tiance has rusted me to speak is to try and get me back into church. But I've been away quite a lot. In the last 6 or so weeks, I've been to Zimbabwe, Malaysia, Vietnam, Thailand, Togo, and back to Zimbabwe, all in the space of 6 weeks. So it's been quite busy. This is my first Sunday off that I've had since then. And so instead of watching the rugby sevens, I'm now speaking at church. But, it's great to be here. And I'm really inspired by the worship tonight. It was just amazing, wasn't it? The last time I spoke I spoke a little bit about what was going on in Syria. So I just want to give you a very quick update about Syria and Aleppo. Who was there for that night? You remember Dr. Johnny? He was doing a lot of work in Aleppo. And those of you who have been watching the news would see that the government forces have retaken Aleppo and forced the rebels, basically the bad guys, further back. And the hospital is still running. Actually, it's the only building I heard from Yanni last week. It's the only building in the whole vicinity, the whole region, that doesn't have a single shrapnel mark or bullet hole in it. So the hospital's still standing with a big cross outside of the hospital. And there's still 18 doctors working in this hospital. And it's actually one of the only functioning places of medical care in the whole city. Most of the other hospitals have closed down. Yanni, he took his daughter, because when the fighting got so bad, because the government just didn't take over the city, there was some significant fighting beforehand. So he took his daughter, who's a doctor, took her to Cyprus and said, please stay here, be safe. He came back to Aleppo to carry on his work. 2 days later, his daughter was in Aleppo, and she somehow found her way back. And he said, well, what are you doing back here? I took you to safety. And she said, I can't be in a place of safety when my brothers and sisters are suffering. I need to be here. So she came back, and we actually heard of another family that we evacuated to Poland, and they made their way back to Aleppo. And we spent quite a bit of money trying to get them to Poland, but then they said they couldn't live in comfort again while their families and friends were suffering. So they wanted to come and suffer with them in Aleppo and help where they could. So a family of about 20 extended family came back to Aleppo. Incredible, incredible stories. Also, another amazing thing happened about 3 weeks ago. I was in Togo. For those of you who don't know where Togo is, it's in West Africa. So at the top of Africa, you've got Nigeria, then you've got Benin, and then you've got Ghana, then you've got Togo. It's a French country. Fairly stable, but all the countries around it, it's very, very difficult to be a Christian. It's, most of the countries are very, very Muslim. And for the first time ever, we've got 60 pastors and leaders, church leaders, together. It's the first time in their history that they felt to be able to come together. And we met together and we spent some time together just figuring out how we deal with Muslim extremism and political Islam, and it was so, and the pressures that they face is so incredible that even during the services that we're having or the discussions we're having, people come up and interrupt the speaker and say, I've just heard a village has been attacked, I've just heard this person has been killed, I've just heard that this church has been burnt down. And yet what was so inspirational is that they never stopped their joyful singing and praising the Lord in amongst all of that. It was just such an incredible time to spend with these pastors. So that's a few things that are going on in the world. I noticed that there are not many people here tonight. It's probably because of the rugby sevens. I was watching it, and I was looking at all the people earlier today, and I was looking at all the fancy dresses, and it reminded me of something that happened last week. So Linda is my wife. She's a doctor. diabetes care. And she had her end of year function last week, Saturday. And I went to an end of year function a couple of years ago with her, and it was like paintball. So she said there's an end of year function, the theme is bling. So I thought, oh, that's great. And I put fancy dress, I'm going all out. I want to impress her colleagues. So I went very similar to Bernie, the Batman pimp, with lots of bling. So I kind of went like I modeled myself on Snoop Dogg, and I was very, very blinged out. I couldn't find the bling tee, but I was trying to aim for that. And so Linda was a little bit more conservative. She got blinged out first, and then she looked at herself in the mirror and said, no, I'm not doing this. So she got into a nice dress and put a couple of shiny things on her. And we got into the elevator, and as we're going up the elevator, somebody walked in and they had a tuxedo on. And I thought, this guy's also going all out. I mean, he's got a tuxedo and he's got a little bit of color, and so yeah, he's dressed well. And then our elevator opens and everyone is in tuxedos. And I'm Snoop Dogg. So I went home and changed very quickly. When something embarrassing happens, you've got to own it. I think you have to own it. So, let's get on with what we need to talk about tonight. So, today marks 10 years since I left Afghanistan. I was an officer in the British Army. I was a captain there. And 10 years ago today, I left. I flew, got into a Hercules airplane, and I left. 7 days later, I left the Army. To work where I'm working now with Barnabas Fund. And I spoke to Tiance because he wanted me to speak today, and we were discussing what we should talk about. And he said the theme is on Thanksgiving, and I said I've just been reflecting on 10 years of my life, a 10-year period of my life, and a 10-year since then of my time in the military. And I've just been thanking God for that time and reflecting on it. And he said, oh, that will be great. Why don't you share it? So there we go. So I'm going to share my time in the military. When I was at the Royal Military Academy Sandhurst, which is quite a fancy place, very, very formal, very fancy, and I was quite cheeky in those days. I'm less cheeky now. As I was saying this morning that I'm now married, so I can't be as cheeky as I used to be, but I was quite cheeky then, and I always used to just, things just came out of my mouth without me thinking about it. On our very first day, we're collecting our rifles, and a Corporal Lee was walking down, and he was taking everyone's names, and with the rifle number and taking everyone's names, and there was a guy sitting next to me, his name was DeBlanche, who was also South African, but he was next to me, and the guy was going down the line, and he was taking everyone's names, and everyone had very easy names, so they had names like White and Jones and Evans and those type of names, and he got to Blanche. And to Blanche, so he said, what is your name? And he said, to Blanche. I said, what? He said, to Blanche. I said, what? He said, to Blanche. And he said, spell it. So he went T-E-R-B-L-A-N-C-H-E. And he went, sorry, spell it again. And he went T-E-R-B-L-A-N-C-H-E. And he spelled it six or seven times. And eventually he got it down, and he got to me, and I was the next guy, and I said, Smith, S-M-I. And this is no jokes. By the time I got to, before I got to TH, I was doing 50 push-ups. So that was day one. Day two, I didn't learn at all. So day two, we were getting our introduction to PT, which is physical training. And physical training at Sandhurst is pretty hectic. You start off slow, like the first run is 3 Ks, but within 3 weeks you're running 21 Ks a day with a 20 kg pack on in army boots in 1 hour, 45 minutes, 6 days a week before you do your PT. So that's your start of every day. So it was pretty hectic, but the guy was introducing this whole PT thing to us, and he was this very muscular, very arrogant PT instructor, and he was saying how great he is, and how amazing he is, and how fit he is, and how he's going to make us die, and how he's going to make us sick, and how he is just so incredible, and he's training for this amazing, the toughest race in the world, and he's got this guy called Bruce Fordyce training with him, and he's just going to do this, the toughest race in the world, and in May, he's going to go and run this race called the Comrades. So I stick up my hand, and I say, staff, please say hello to my mother. She's running it for her 9th time. And at the back of the hall, the guy says, his name is Smith, if you're interested. And he said, oh, I'm interested. So I was very fit that year. The PT instructor made me very, very fit. But those were my very first few 2 days at Sandhurst. It didn't improve, but it was just an introduction. So Sandhurst is quite a formal place. Some of the people who've gone there, the guys always recognize the Queen. The girls always recognize Prince Harry and Prince William. Another guy who went there, any guesses? No? James Blunt, yeah. So he was there as well. By the way, the princes, they're really, really nice guys, very down to earth. I specialized in humanitarian aid. One of the reasons why I joined the British Army, my mother's Scottish, which allowed me to go, but they do recruit from the Commonwealth. One of the reasons I was quite affected by what was going on in Bosnia and Kosovo at that time, and I saw that there was a section within the military that did specialize in humanitarian aid, so I thought I would join and specialize in that. So I joined and I specialized in humanitarian aid. It's a non-combatant role, basically the same as doctors. You're not expected to fight. So I went and went to a place called Afghanistan. This is where it is in the world. It is surrounded by some really interesting countries. That's top corner over there is China, then Pakistan, Iran, Turkmenistan, Uzbekistan, and Tajikistan. And I know what everyone is thinking. Where's Borat? He lives over here. Kazakhstan. So very quick facts about it. I'm not going to spend much time on this, but it's one of the coldest countries in the world. Temperatures get to minus 30, and I was camping out in temperatures like that. It's crazy cold. About 60% of the country is inaccessible during those times. It's a very mountainous place. I was based in Kabul, which is the capital of Afghanistan. Even Kabul was 3,000 meters above sea level. So it's very high. Some of the passes we used to drive up, there's one particular pass that got to about 5,800 something meters above sea level. So at that height, altitude, vehicles struggle because they don't have enough oxygen. We don't have enough oxygen. But it's also the fourth hottest place on Earth. In summer, the average temperature minimum is about 40 degrees, maximum is about 49 degrees. So every day you're sitting somewhere between 40 and 49. Makes it very, very, very difficult to operate in. I remember once sitting in a tent and looking at the thermometer in the tent, and it said 64 degrees. So it was a very, very hot place. It has a culture that goes back thousands of years. One of the oldest cultures in the world. Alexander the Great was there in 300 BC. He was the only person to ever conquer Afghanistan. The Russians tried. They were there. They lost 80,000 soldiers before they pulled out. Even Rambo tried, and so he was there. In 2001, September the 11th happened, a group of extremists known as Al-Qaeda, flew some airplanes into the World Trade Center, into the Pentagon, and the U.S. invoked something called Article 5. The USA is part of NATO, and within NATO there are a number of different articles, but it's a collective force, and Article 5 says an attack on one is an attack on all. So they said, we'd like to go into Afghanistan, we've been attacked, this big data to come with us into this. And so they went in and discovered that Al-Qaeda were being housed and supported by another extremist group called the Taliban. These guys are like hectically evil. They're really, really bad. They practice a very, very extreme form of Islam. They, in Afghanistan during their rule, women couldn't do anything. The women had to wear full burqas when they left the house. Women couldn't, they couldn't learn, they couldn't attend a doctor, they couldn't go to school, they couldn't do anything. Even then it was difficult. Men, there was no music, no one could play music, music was banned, you couldn't even draw, you couldn't drive, you couldn't play sports. So they had this real oppressive, and you felt it when you got there, this oppression that existed over this country. And you can see some punishment that's happening over there, some more punishment. This is a woman who was caught in adultery, or suspected adultery, it turned out. And that, I don't know if you can see on this picture, but there is a bullet splash as she's been executed. This happened in the Afghan stadium, the big soccer stadium. Thankfully, their days have returned, and there's soccer there, but this woman was being executed. I heard a story, our interpreter had said that he had to attend one of these executions, and they played this game with the goats. It's kind of like polo, but you play it with a goat. And what they did once with the woman is they tied her in a sack and played polo with her like that. It was hectic. It's hectic. We based ourselves, our headquarters are actually based at the Taliban headquarters because we pushed them out, and we based ourselves at where their headquarters were. And we were putting up buildings and prefabs and tents and things like that. And it wasn't uncommon to find skeletons as we were digging through the soil and things. So their rule was pretty crazy. America pretty much went in looking for Osama bin Laden. It was quite a difficult thing to find him there. It took many, many years to find him. He was in and out of Afghanistan, but they eventually found him a few years ago in Pakistan. So there was that one role was to try and find Osama bin Laden. The other role was also to try and reduce the impact of the Taliban. Another role, which I was involved in, which was the rebuilding of the country. The country had been closed for about 20 years, and there were no schools. There were no buildings. There was no infrastructure. It was a complete failed state, and a failed state that had been failed for about 20 years. And so sanitation was non-existent. Rule of law was non-existent. It was a crazy, crazy place. So we went in, and our job in there was to basically provide security for the UN to come and rebuild the country, but also for my unit to do some rebuilding ourselves. So this is my unit. We were 26 officers from 19 different countries. And we did a whole lot of things. We coordinated the relief effort into Afghanistan. We built roads, hospitals, orphanages, schools. We built about 200 schools in the year that I was there. 20 of them were burnt down with girls inside, and they closed the doors and just set the building alight. Thousands of girls were killed. It was the Taliban just saying women can't be educated. So it was a heartbreaking time for us. You build a school and try and encourage girls to go, and suddenly they're not there. We also did things like put in a police force and judicial system and all of that. It was a busy time. This is an orphanage that we built, before we built it, we were renovating it. A handicapped hospital for kids we set up. Provided things for kids and old people. One of the things we did was rebuild the Afghan sports. This is the very first day of the Afghan cricket team getting together. Sports had been banned for 20 years, so cricket didn't exist. So we got people who were interested in cricket together, and we tried try to reform the Afghan cricket team. So we set up training programs, we got the sponsorship, some uniforms, set up nets for them. This is the cricket ground that we started on. And this is the Afghan team just a few years ago winning the Asia Cup. And they're now in the World Cup and doing so well. This guy over here, he sat next to me at a banquet when we launched the team for the first time, the national team for the first time. And he told me that he used to be in the Taliban, but he liked cricket so much he decided to leave the Taliban to play cricket. So the power of sport, eh? The other thing we did was we did the volleyball team. We did the same thing with volleyball and soccer and other things like that. The volleyball team has also had quite a bit of success in the region. I don't follow volleyball. I don't know if anyone does, but apparently they're very good. This is a tournament that we set up as a launch of the national team. It's the first time the team actually played together as a national team, and they played a whole lot of other teams that we set up, and we entered a team ourselves. This guy over here, his name is Mike Navakaliva. He was my roommate. Let me just to take a side little side story about him. So when I arrived in Afghanistan, the camp that I was in had about 2,500 people. And as far as I was aware, I was the only Christian on this camp. And I know this because I sent, at Easter time, I sent a circular around saying, hey, it's Easter. We need to celebrate the Lord's resurrection. If anyone is interested, please join me. I'm going to be having a service. So I set up a room and I sat there waiting for anyone to come, and no one came. I gave a great preach that day, apparently, but no one attended. And I said to the Lord after that, I said, I can't do this. I can't be here for a whole year on my own. It's too much. And a few days later, my roommate, who was staying with me, stayed in a little shipping container, and he said he's been posted out and he's been replaced. And I said, Lord, please, I need a Christian roommate. And the Lord sent Mike Navakaliva. And he walked in, and his first words were to me, hi, I'm Mike. I hope you don't mind. I get up very early to have a quiet time. And those are his first words to me. And he did get up very early. He used to get up, and he had like five Bibles, and he sat on his bed, and he like studied for 2 or 3 hours. He was an amazing guy, amazing guy. And he said to me, right, when is the church service? And I said, well, I am the church service. I told him about Easter. I told him I'd preach. Seemed to enjoy it as well. So, but he said, okay, now we need to change this. And so he said, okay, what we're going to do is we're going to pray for the guys who are in the room next to us, and the room next to us, and the room opposite us. So every day, we're going to pray for them. So every day, we prayed. He also said to me, right, this stuff doesn't happen on its own. We have to fast. So he said, okay, one day a week we're fasting, and 1 week a month we're fasting. So for a whole year, that's what he did. So it was about to have him with such a guy, but he challenged me. He was an amazing guy. So we prayed for the guys next to us and opposite us, and the guy next to us became a Christian. Came in and said, I just feel like I need to talk to you guys about something. So talking to him. He's actually left the army, gone into full-time ministry. So he's amazing. So he joined us, and another guy joined us, and another guy joined us. Eventually, we had like 16 guys meeting in this tiny, tiny little room. And so we said, no, we need to start a church service. So we're going to try to start a church service. So on Sunday, I set up about 20 chairs in great expectation. We had 16 people. I had a faith for another 4 people. So I had real faith for 4 people. Mike said, no, we're not doing 20. We're going to put 60 out. So he had more faith than I did. We put 60 out. 80 people came to the first church service. So that was incredible. There was standing. I mean, people were standing there. But there is no. There's a saying that there's no atheist in a foxhole or a firefight. And when people are faced with the realities of their own city. They really just, you know, seek for something. And actually, life is very, very simple. When you pray, take all this other rubbish that we face around the world and put people in a place that is like life and death, people will want to choose life. And I think that's a message for us when we speak to people. You say, what do you want to choose, life or death? And they're going to say life. And there's something to tell you about life. And so it's a great opportunity to talk to people. We set up every day, we have a prayer group. Before people went out and patrolled in the city, they used to go through the prayer group to pray. We didn't make anyone do it. We just said, if you want it. And every single patrol went out and was praying for people that went out. We saw amazing things in people's lives delivered. We ran alpha courses. Lots of people came to know the Lord. We actually had to have two services on a Sunday, morning and evening. We left probably about 200 people attending the services. So really, really amazing opportunity. And the church carried on when I left. But so that's Mike. He started all that off. And so Mike, in this volleyball situation, he said to me, look, we need to put together a team. Do you want to play volleyball? And I said, no, Mike, I can play a few sports, but volleyball is not my sport. And he said, no, anyone can play volleyball. I said, no, Mike, really, I can't play volleyball. So I went to practice and touched the ball about two times. And he said, okay, Brendan, you're right. You really, really can't play volleyball. So I was replaced with a girl. And she was very good. She was very good. Deep respect for women, sportswoman. So she was really good. She actually turned out to be the star of the team. So good choice by Mike. During the volleyball tournament, we ended up being in the final against the Afghan team. And in the final, we were match point down, failing by about 12 points. And Mike said, pulled us together, and he said, we're not losing to a Muslim team. And the Lord is on our side. So he said, I want all of you, and I think there were about three of us who were Christian, who professed to be Christian. And he said, I want all of you to get on your knees now. We pray to the Lord. So in the middle of the game, and it was quite a big spectacle. There were launching the Afghan team, so there were quite a few hundred people watching us. So we got down on our knees in the middle of the match, and Mike said, Lord, if we give you the glory now, please give us the glory in the match. And we didn't lose another point after that, and we beat them. So that was the faith of Mike Novakaliva, an amazing guy. Is he getting the prize for the best water boy? Here, just a few pictures, just out of interest. Afghanistan produces 95% of the world's heroin. This is the poppy field. One of our big things was anti-narcotics. It's a very, very complicated and difficult thing to do. Here's some pictures of some of the people of Afghanistan. Amazing people, really. I fell in love with the people, fell in love with the place. See the woman in burqas. This is a woman carrying a very, very sick child to the hospital. This is the police station in the capital city of the largest province in Afghanistan. So this is a blonde-headed Afghan. Now, there are probably two reasons for this blonde-headed Afghan. The first reason is probably the Russians. They were there for a number of years, almost 10 years, and there are a lot of blonde-headed Afghans now around. Another thing is I was in a marketplace with one of my fellow officers who was Greek, and we were looking at Afghan carpets. That's another thing that we did was revive the Afghan carpet industry. So you go into these malls and you see these Afghan carpets. That didn't exist. There was no economy, there was nothing. And this was part of our anti-narcotics thing, saying, guys, instead of trading heroin, what do you have to trade? And they said, well, we're very good at carpets. So we said, okay, well, let's see what we can do. So that's one of the, I think, a great success story. But anyway, so we're in the market with this Greek officer, and the store owner says to his son, go and get another carpet. And he says it in ancient Greek. And the son goes off, and he comes back. And this Greek officer with me is able to converse with this guy in Greek. And it turns out there's a whole community from Alexander the Great, from 300 BC. It's still there, because Alexander died of malaria in and around Afghanistan. And one of his wives was Roxanne, an Afghan woman. And there's a whole community that have just kept this culture. And there's a whole lot of blonde Afghan people who are actually from Greek extraction there. It's fascinating. Meat was just, this is how they cured the meat. This is an open sewer over there. There's no business. Sanitation is non-existent. Kids just being kids. A land of contrasts. This over here is just like fine, fine powder. It's like talcum powder. It's crazy. If the wind blows, you can't breathe. So I was based over here, a place called Kabul, which is the headquarters, and we were part of the headquarters. We coordinated all the humanitarian aid efforts that happened around the country. Over here, there's a place called Kandahar. In 2006, there was a battle called of Medusa, and it was the fiercest battle that's ever been fought in Afghanistan before or since. Now, Afghanistan had the highest incident rate out of any war that America or Britain have ever faced. So worse than the Second World War, worse than the Philippines, the Falklands, worse than Vietnam. I remember seeing a sign once in a cookhouse, and it said, every 8 hours a soldier dies. What are you doing about it? So it was very, very busy. My very first day in Afghanistan, my first night, we were staying in a, as I said, shipping containers, and if this is the wall of my shipping container, and I'm sleeping, the other shipping container was over there by the whatever that prayer room is over there. And in the middle of the night, I heard this whoosh come past my ear. And I sat bolt upright. What the heck was that? And there was this massive explosion. And what had happened is an Afghan had fired an RPG that had come in between the two shipping containers and then blew up right next to us. And I was like, whoa, this is crazy, the first day here. And my roommate, he just put this pillow over his head and he said, welcome to Afghanistan. And so that was my introduction to Afghanistan. On average, we probably face one or two of those a week. Sometimes one or two of those a day. It was quite a busy time. And so there was a major battle over here in Kandahar called Up Medusa. There was about 150,000 civilians that were displaced during this fighting. And they descended upon this town, Kandahar, which only had a population of 200,000. So in a space of a few days, the population almost doubled with refugees. And the town couldn't handle it. The local military that were there couldn't handle it. And they called us up at the headquarters and said, you guys are the specialists. You need to come and sort this out. So So I said, yes, I'm definitely going to go there, thinking that we would send helicopters and vehicles and all of that down there. But out of those 19 nationalities that were in our unit, only two said that they were prepared to send their soldiers into a combat zone. That was crazy. I thought, you know, you soldiers, you're going to go into a combat zone. And they said, no, it's too dangerous for our soldiers. So they would only send a Brit and a Hungarian. So instead of I was expecting 40 people when I volunteered, I was less enthusiastic when I knew there were only two of us. So this is Norbert, the Hungarian. So he and I got sent down to Kandahar to sort out a refugee crisis of 150,000 people. So it was a little bit challenging, a little bit interesting. Norbert and I, when we were going out, before we had to go out, we were non-combatants, so we only actually carried our sidearms, which is a 9mm pistol, and that was for our own personal protection. They said we needed to take our rifles with us. So we went to the armory to get our rifles, and we're getting a bit of attitude from the armorer. We were saying, why are you guys going? You guys are the humanitarian guys. You don't need big weapons. Why are you going? And we said, we go to our producer. And he said, oh, our producer, okay. Here's your rifle. Here's 30 magazines. Here's 3,000 rounds. Here's 12 hand grenades. Good luck. So Norbert and I came out of this thing. So Norbert's eyes got very, very big, and he said, look, he's got a young kid, he's got a partner, he's not, you know, ready to die just yet, and he's a little bit scared about going down. And he said to me, you know, you're a believer. And I said, yes. And he said, aren't you scared? And I said, no, I thought God would protect us. And he said, how do you have that faith? I said, look, I pray to God, and I feel, you know, the Lord is with me. So he said, look, I don't know how to pray. Would you mind praying with me? And so I said to him, okay, that's good. So I said, praying is very, very simple. It's just a conversation between you and God. And he said, he's not quite sure if he's ready for that. But I said, okay, well, maybe what we should do is just read Psalm 91 together. So we read Psalm 91. And the words here are just quite amazing. Live under the protection of God Most High, and stay in the shadow of God All Powerful. Then you will say to the Lord, you are my fortress, my place of safety. You are my God, and I trust you. The Lord will keep you safe from secret traps and deadly diseases. He will spread his wings over you and keep you secure. His faithfulness is like a shield or a city wall. You will not need to worry about dangers at night or arrows during the day. You won't fear diseases that strike in the dark or sudden disaster at noon. You will not be harmed. Though thousands fall around you, and with your own eyes you will see the punishment of the wicked. The Lord Most High is your fortress. Run to him for safety, and no terrible disasters will strike you or your home. God will command his angels to protect you wherever you go. They will carry you in their arms, and you won't hurt your feet on the stones. You will overpower the strongest of lions and the most deadly snakes. The Lord says, if you love me and truly know who I am, I will rescue you and keep you safe. When you're in trouble, call out to me, and I will answer and be there to protect and honor you. You will live a long life and see my saving power. Now, Norbert had never heard these words before. So it was quite an honor praying this prayer with him. So he said, look, you know, I'm still not quite ready to make that step to believe in God, but I know you believe in God, so I'm going to ride this thing with you. So we got into this Hercules, which is it's a massive airplane. And this one, out of interest, is the oldest flying Hercules in the world. The pilot actually made us take this picture. He said, you never know what is going to happen. So that didn't fill us with any confidence. So, and also, there was a surface-to-air missile threat, which was not very specific, it was quite general, and they said somewhere in Afghanistan there's a group of people that have a surface-to-air missile that are going to try and shoot down military aircraft. So we had to fly 1,400 Ks, and surface-to-air missiles only arm after 300 meters, so we flew 1,400 Ks under 300 meters. So it was... And going over these mountains was crazy. I was sick within 20 minutes for 3 hours. I filled three sick bags. I didn't even have breakfast that morning. I don't know how I did that. But it was a crazy flight. This is pretty much our route that we took. stomach. It was a horrific flight. And so we arrive and we're supposed to catch a lift to that, where the battle's taking place. And we're coordinated, so we arrive in Kandahar military air base, and we get a Chinook helicopter, and they're going to fly us with the team that we're supposed to be in. So we just there coordinating the effort. There's actually a whole big team that is with us, helping us. And the team we initially were with was a group of about 20 Canadians. And so when you get there, they say, okay, the helicopter's over there. It's leaving in 3 hours. Be back there in 3 hours. And all that's a great time to recover, rehydrate. And so we just rested for 3 hours, and we got to where? Place 3 o'clock, and this we got there. So, oh no, we're trying to find you guys. The helicopter's left without you. I know. And we're supposed to be coordinating this thing, but they've just left us. So they did just leave us. The helicopter landed. The group got out. They went on a patrol. And usually, when you patrol, you've got a perimeter that you try and keep people out of. It's like a 20 meter perimeter. You don't let people come too close, but as you can see, things are quite busy, and people do come in and out. But you're also trying to not be too, you want to still be friendly to the people because not everyone's the enemy. And you're doing a bit of hearts and minds, trying to win the local population's trust. And a father with his son and his wife came to this group, and he said to them, my son just wants to shake the hand of a NATO soldier. Guys have done so much for us. Thank you so much for everything you did. And so I said, okay, yeah, that's great. So the son's shaking up the hands of these soldiers, Canadian soldiers, the father detonates a bomb in his bicycle and kills himself. His wife, his child, 6 Canadian soldiers, and another 6 lost arms and legs. It's pretty hectic. And we actually, Norbert and I were in the ops room when all of this was happening. And the commander in the ops room said, wasn't that the patrol you guys were supposed to be on? If you caught the helicopter. And Norbert's eyes just grew a little bit bigger. This is some guys being evac'd when they landed back at the military base. And just a memorial service for some of the fallen. We still needed to get out there, so we went served by a helicopter, which was going to take was just going to take 20 minutes. We had to go by road, which was now going to take 3 or 4 days. So we went in a vehicle like this. It's called a Nyala. It's South African made, but the Canadians use it. What's really, really impressive about this vehicle is it has a 90% success rate or survival rate. So if you get hit by a bomb or landmine or something like that, you've got about a 90% chance of survival. The other vehicles, you can see these vehicles in the background, they're called Buffaloes. You've got about a 60% chance of survival. This is South African made, and I don't know why it's so good, but it is good. So we went in one of these vehicles, and we got to this camp called Camp Wilson. When we got there, the commander, Camp Wilson, said, right, guys, every morning at dawn, every day at sunset, we usually get attacked from this area over here, sometimes from over here, but this is where you're going to be sitting. So just position your rifle over here. There's going to be about between 100 and 200 Afghans that are going to try and attack you, so just be prepared. So we thought, well, this is an amazing introduction to the camp. So I said, gee, how long has this been going for? He said, oh, no, every day for 3 months. So every day for 3 months, this camp had been attacked, either through people, RPGs or mortars or people trying to forcefully attack it. And you can't see so well in this picture, but there's a whole lot of walls over there. And they basically sat there and sniped at people or tried to attack. And they attacked every day for 3 months. Except for 3 nights, Norbert and I were there. It was the only time that we weren't attacked. Actually, it was quite a boring 3 days that we stayed there. We didn't know what to do. I always carry a tennis ball around with me. Byron will relate. You always have to have a ball. So we played lots of hand tennis. But you can see effects of all the fighting that had happened. This is just bullets that have come through the wall. And this, I just love this picture. And Norma took it, just like, even though the bullets all around, you can just still rest in the Lord. A few seconds after this picture was taken, I was woken up, and told to get into this vehicle. And they said, right, you're finally going out into the battle. You're going in this vehicle. So Norbert and I got into the vehicle, and as the vehicle was turning, going out, there was a bang on the door, and they said, whoa, Norbert and me, please get out. We need to put these two guys and you go into this other vehicle. So the vehicle left, and about 2 minutes later, we just heard this huge explosion, and the vehicle had been hit by a bomb. And this is the vehicle that had been hit. So they had left out of the south gate. We still needed to get out there, and things just happened. You know, this has happened. It doesn't stop things. We still need to get out there, so we jumped into another vehicle, and this other vehicle wouldn't start. And so they said, okay, what we'll do is we're going to send a vehicle from a convoy through the north gate, and it's going to pick you up. And we were going to go through the north gate, and the vehicle that was supposed to come pick us up would blow up. So when the vehicle didn't start, I was like really upset about this. I'm like, we need to get there. We spent 3 days trying to get you. Stupid helicopter. We should have been there like 3 days ago. Lots of stuff needs to happen. And Norbert says, whoa. You know, things happen for a purpose. And he says, if the vehicle doesn't start, maybe God's saying something to you. So so he was like, yeah, exactly. He was starting to tell me. And then when the second vehicle got blown up, Norbert asked if he could borrow my Bible. So during this time, Norbert gave his life to the Lord. He's now serving the Lord faithfully. And so he just really had a real tangible experience of God's provision. We eventually got to the battle scene. Probably these 3 days also maybe helped, because the battle had actually finished about 2 or 3 hours before we got to the battle. So we got there, and there were still like smoldering things and bodies all over the place, but we actually never saw the battle actually happening. We were linked up with an American group for a couple of days, and we were doing some work with them. And then we finished our work, and they said, okay, the Americans are going here, you need to stay behind and work with the Canadians. So the Americans are leaving. Change vehicles, go with the Canadians. So we changed vehicles. This is the vehicle that we were in. And we were leaving a few moments after this picture was taken. This is what the vehicle that we were traveling in looked like. So this vehicle, there's 4 vehicles in front of us, completely disintegrated. The Canadians, by this stage, who were with us around, they started calling me the miracle man, because all of these crazy things that started happening. And they also started saying that they all wanted to travel with me. Because the Lord has got, you know, they didn't know, not all of them were Christian, but they said, there's something about you. And I said, no, it's not about me, it's about God. So we stayed like, right in the open under the stars. And we'd go for a patrol in the morning. So you patrol just before dawn, and you patrol just after sunset, and you do a perimeter patrol, and we would find in our morning patrol, so we're sleeping out in the open like this, booby traps. The closest one we found was about 15 meters from where we're sleeping. So the Taliban were operational there. This is the biggest battle that's ever been fought in Afghanistan. There were hundreds of Taliban there. There were only 12 of us, but we were protected by three companies, which is about 300 Afghan soldiers from the National Afghan Army. So they were protecting us. So when we were doing our work, sort of setting up for the United Nations to come in and do relief efforts with food drops and water supplies and things like that, we were securing the area for them. Before they arrived, these guys were protecting us, these 300. But they had been fighting for 6 weeks. And when the Americans left, because the Americans have big tanks and everything. They left. They left 12 of us, Norbert and I, and 10 Canadians. And the Afghan army said, right, we've had enough. We're leaving. We've been fighting for 6 weeks. We're going home. So they left us, 12 of us. And we knew the Taliban were all around us. And we were expecting it. This is our last night. And we knew they were around us because of all the booby traps. I had a satellite phone, and they were phoning their families and said they loved them. And we set up a perimeter expecting to be attacked that night, overrun. And nothing happened that night. Nothing happened. And these Afghans made a huge noise when they left. So I don't know. The Lord must have protected us that night. A few days later, the battle had pretty much finished. News arrived, BBC, CNN, all of the big guys were there, and we had to escort them around to the various places where the battle happened, and they could report from where the battle was. And we walked down this path like this, and there were about 40 of us. We walked down the path, and they all reported from the front line, and then they walked back, and about halfway through, I was in the middle, one of the guys just in front of me said, hey, what's this shiny thing on this path? And 40 of us had gone across and 20 had come back and missed a landmine. I don't know how that happened on the path like that. Someone must have stepped on it. And it was a live landmine because the engineers came and detonated it. But this is what a landmine would have done. This is a caterpillar that would have been hit by a landmine. Remember that group of 20 that I said that we were supposed to join? We eventually ended up with them. This is the group that was left out of the 20 that we were supposed to be with that weren't injured in that initial bomb. Some pictures of what it was like there, like the lunar landscape. Often went on patrols to secure different areas. And Afghanistan is a very conservative place, so when you have to go to the toilet, you can't just go to the side of the road. You have to go and hide yourself somewhere. So we needed the toilet after being in the vehicle for about 6 hours, so we had to stop and go over the hill. And we stopped and we went over the hill. And my sergeant was at the car, and he called back to me on the radio. He said, So there's a whole lot of Afghans around us. They're very agitated. And I said, what do you mean agitated? He said, he doesn't know. I said, are they friendly? Or they're non-friendly? He said, no, they seem friendly, but they're very concerned about something. They're very, very animated. And then it was very silent. And then later, just a few seconds later, he said, sir, I think they're saying that there's landmines. And we had stepped into a landmine field. And there were about, in Afghanistan, there's probably, at that time, there were probably about 20 million landmines that went cleared. And we walked in about 40 or 50 meters into an uncleared landmine field. And, you think your feet are stable, 2 feet, but suddenly when you're in a landmine field, you're very unsure of your feet. You don't know what to do. We actually have certain procedures that we do, but we didn't quite know how to do them. So we're stuck in the middle of this field. And I had a landmine clearing kit, which happened to be in my jacket, which happened to be in the vehicle, which I'd left behind, which is a bit stupid. But anyway, we retraced our steps. Somehow, the 6 of us that went across, nothing had happened. And the next video that you're going to see, every one of those white rocks, when a landmine is cleared, you paint a rock and you put it over there to say this was a landmine site. This is what a landmine is being cleared. So think of a field where all of these white stones represent landmines. This is what we're walking into. So I had to get out of that place. I've been there for about 2 weeks to finish up and get to another operation that I had to coordinate, and so I had to leave, and so I was being escorted back to the airport. On our way there, the vehicle tried to crash into us, missed us, hit the vehicle behind us, and blew up. It was a suicide bomb. I was actually leaning up against the window, the back door, and it was the biggest noise I'd ever heard. The whole vehicle turned upside down. It was crazy. There was fire. There was explosions. There was the biggest noise you've ever heard in your whole life. And then there was another two explosions that happened after that, and we just got out of there. Turned out that we'd been hit by a suicide bomber, and the suicide bomber had detonated himself, killed 19 civilians in the region, but no one in our vehicle was hurt. This is what landmines and suicide bombs look like. A white car. This is very, very similar to what happened to us. That's what it looks like from inside. This is what it looks like from outside. Went off about 1.5 meters from my ear. What had happened from pure provision, the vehicle behind us was an Inyala. The suicide vehicle failed to hit us, and the Inyala rode over the vehicle and absorbed the whole blast of the vehicle and saved us. The engineers, they looked at this afterwards, and they said that if that hadn't happened, about 3 or 4 of our vehicles would have been completely vaporized just because of this Niala. So the driver in this Niala, there was a 7th suicide bomb that he had survived. Yeah, amazing. Amazing. So that happened on the Tuesday. I had to leave. Norbert is still there. Norbert says, hey, I'm not staying here on my own. And he says, I'm not leaving, not stepping out of the door unless a Christian comes with me. So Mike gets called in. Mike is a little bit less impressed because he's got 5 kids and he's going down there. And Mike did an amazing job. Actually, they named a bridge after him. When I was there, they said, I asked them, what could we do? And they said, there's a village that's divided by a river, and for about 7 months of the year, the river flows, and people can't visit each other. And the one guy said, he lives on one side of the river, and his other 5 wives live on the other side of the river. And I said, what do you want to do? And they said, well, please, can we build a bridge? And so I said, okay, we can try and figure out how to build a bridge. And then he got thinking about whether he should see his wives for so long. Maybe the bridge is not a good idea. But anyway, I left. Mike went there, built the bridge, and there's a plaque in Afghanistan, the Mike Novikuliva Bridge. Anyway, so Mike arrived. We had handed over on Wednesday. This is Mike leaving, and he arrives there on Thursday. Do you remember that black and white photo of those 6 Canadians that were still left? This happened on the Wednesday that we went there. They got hit by a roadside bomb. Luckily, they all survived. So that was 2 weeks of my life 10 years ago in Afghanistan. It's a crazy story. It's not really relevant to our lives here, but is it? You know, we live in a place where uncertainty exists every day. I'm sure we've got all stories of near misses, and if it wasn't for this, you know, this could have happened. And I just want to challenge all of us that every day we need to put our trust in the Lord. Every day need to get onto our knees and acknowledge that God is our provider. I get annoyed when I see this car is protected by Psalm 91. You know, it's not. This car is not protected by Psalm 91. This computer is not protected by Psalm 91. This house is not protected by Psalm 91. This house is protected by the Lord. The Lord is our provider and our protector. Psalm 91 just explains how he does it. But I think every day we need to do it. We need to get onto our knees, acknowledge who God is, put our trust in Him, put our faith in Him that He is going to provide for us, He's going to protect us. We might be in crazy situations like this. We might just be walking down the road. We might be anywhere. Wherever God calls us, we don't know. God can call us into anything. But God needs to be our provider and our protector. So I just want to challenge you. Crazy stories that might trigger your memory about Psalm 91, about His provision. I just love this this last bit. It's also a chance to evangelize to other people. People are scared. But we have the Lord. We trust the Lord. I think we're okay. If we die, things are going to be okay. There are lots of people there who live in fear, who don't know what is going to happen. In this country, there are lots of people living in fear. Lots of people uncertain about finances, about security, about all kinds of stuff. This is a great opportunity to tell people about how the Lord can protect us. And that this is, if you love me and truly know who I am, it's an invitation. I will rescue and keep you safe. When you're in trouble, call out to me, and I will answer and be there to protect and honor you. We'll have a long life and see my Savior. This is great. Lord, we just thank you that you are our provider and our protector. You know our deepest fears. You know our worries. You know the things that concern us. Lord, we right now give these things over to you and say that they're your things to worry about, your things to help us through, Lord. We get onto our knees and acknowledge that we cannot go through this life on our own. We want to further your kingdom, and when we further your kingdom, Lord, we're going to come into opposition. We cannot just go into it without protection. Lord, I pray that you would just arm us with the armor that we need. Protect us. Protect each one of us. And Lord, when you come across people who need to know about you, who live in fear and who are worried about their situations, Lord, let us be sparked off to share the stories about how you've protected us. How you've protected the heroes of the Bible, Lord. So we just thank you for all that you've